On WSOR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBEV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, this is Alex Lieberman with your WSOR News headlines for Friday. You may have to get up earlier after all. The governor signed a bill that would allow Florida school districts to get around later start times for middle and high schools. In 2023, the legislature passed a law that set requirements for school start times. High school cannot start before 8:30 and middle school before 8. That law will take effect July 1st next year. But now, Ron DeSantis signed a bill that would allow school districts to outline consequences of a later start time and create alternative strategies instead of actually adjusting their schedules. Jennifer Bradley, the Republican senator who sponsored the new bill, said that the 2023 one was well-intentioned, but that school districts would have to spend money on new buses and hire hard-to-find bus drivers. The downtown building boom continues. A controversial Twin Tower high-rise project in downtown cleared a major hurdle in the Sarasota City Commission this week. During a nearly 8-hour-long meeting on Monday, the owner of the historic Miramar building was granted an amendment to the comprehensive plan. This could allow Seaward Development to build two 18-story luxury condo towers behind the historic structure, 8 stories taller than current zoning allows. The developer has argued it needs the added revenues from taller buildings to compensate for the renovation costs of the Miramar. The commission approved the change unanimously, despite city staff recommending against it. Now, a rezoning hearing will likely occur this summer. Meanwhile, another developer is seeking approval to demolish a former grocery store at Midtown Plaza at US 41 and Bayadista Street, just south of downtown. In its stead, John Meshad of Midtown Associates wants to build a 6-story complex with a hotel, 112 apartments, one-fourth of them attainable, and a parking garage. On Tuesday, the new Pope's brother and his wife met Donald Trump and J.D. Vance at the White House. Louis Prevost, Pope Leo XIV's brother, who lives in Port Charlotte, is, according to Trump, a, quote, major MAGA fan, and the president said that he wanted to hug him. Prevost said that to avoid creating issues for his brother, he will, quote, tone it down in regards to his beliefs. This has been Alex Zimmerman with your WSLR News headlines.
The following program was pre-recorded in front of an audience of one real live cat. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, who at the music and arts venue Fogartyville provide a center for creative expression and community engagement that amplifies the voices of our diverse community and promotes peace, sustainability, democracy, and economic and social justice. I am Lou Larini, and thanks for tuning in to Surreal News, where we offer opinions, comments, and perspective on the events of the week, which do not necessarily represent the station, its board, or anyone else other than the person who expressed them. I suppose the main event of this week was the passage of that big, beautiful bill in the House of Representatives by the narrowest of margins. Of course, it must also be passed by the Senate, which promises to make changes, but it seems the key provision of the bill, a massive tax cut for the wealthiest among us, will remain and explode the deficit, triggering many of the fail-safe policies Republicans put in place to make sure that Democrats never gave anybody anything without first taking it away from someone else with a process known as sequestration. And in other not-so-very-surprising news, the Justice Department is dropping negotiations for court-approved settlements with Minneapolis and Louisville police agencies, despite previously finding that authorities routinely violated the civil rights of black people. So, walking, driving, biking, and just being while black will still be enough to get a person murdered by the state. Stay tuned until half past the hour to hear my conversation with author and Yale professor Michael Brains about his new book, The Rivalry Peril, How Great Power Competition Threatens Peace and Weakens Democracy, relates to the current trade war with China. The president and his stooges in Congress adamantly claimed funding for Medicare would never be cut. Hear how that's not so certain now. The sprawling reconciliation package that House Republicans are rushing through committee would trigger over $500 billion in automatic cuts to Medicare, according to the Congressional Budget Office estimate released this week. The CBO analysis requested by Rep. Brendan Boyle, Democrat from Pennsylvania, came just hours before Republicans convened a dead-of-night House Rules Committee hearing on the budget legislation as they scramble to meet their Memorial Day deadline. If enacted, the Republican bill would add trillions of dollars to the deficit over the next decade by delivering another round of tax cuts skewed to the rich, partially offset by huge cuts to Medicaid and other programs. According to the CBO, the bill's addition to the deficit would trigger a process known as sequestration under the statutory Pay-as-you-go Act of 2010, a law long reviled by progressives that requires spending cuts equal to legislation's average deficit impact. Unless lawmakers offset the deficit impact of the Republican bill or agree to waive PAYGO requirements, which the GOP measure does not, the Office of Management and Budget would be required to issue a sequestration order not more than 14 days after the end of the current session of Congress to reduce spending by $230 billion in fiscal year 2026, the CBO said. The deficit will explode so badly it will trigger automatic cuts, including over $500 billion from Medicare. Under PAYGO, automatic Medicare cuts are capped at 4%. The CBO estimates that the Republican legislation would trigger roughly $45 billion in Medicare cuts in 2026 and a total of $490 billion cuts to the program between 2027 and 2034. This is really the breaking news, Boyle said. Over the last several months, there's been no discussion of Medicare at all. There has been of Medicaid, but not Medicare. Because of the size of the deficits, because of the PAYGO or Pay-as-you-go Act that would trigger sequestration of Medicare, that would be a total of over $500 billion, Boyle continued. The official figure that the CBO confirms is $535 billion in cuts to Medicare. Boyle and other Democrats said the looming Medicare cuts amount to a betrayal of President Donald Trump's vow to shield the program, a promise that was included in the GOP's 2024 election platform. They're not just cutting Medicaid, said Rep. Teresa Fernandez, referring to the reconciliation bills, roughly $600 billion in proposed cuts to the health care program for low-income Americans. They're cutting Medicaid, too. Medicare, too. House Budget Committee Democrats wrote on social media that Trump promised to protect Medicare. He lied, they added. Cuts to Medicaid will leave some rural Americans with literally no place to go for treatment. One struggling Florida rural hospital is among 300 nationwide that are at immediate risk of closure, a new report says. The report comes as Medicaid changes are contemplated in the House Republican budget bill unveiled earlier this week. The report from the Center for Healthcare Quality and Payment Reform said that the proposed cuts threaten to upend healthcare in some of the nation's most vulnerable communities. Some 66 million Americans live in rural areas, according to the 2020 census, including about 9.1% of Florida residents, according to America Community Survey data. Florida has 22 open rural hospitals at one. An immediate risk of shutting down represents 5% of the state's rural hospitals. And all seven of Florida's rural hospitals are threatened by the proposed cuts, the report said. Nationally, about 700 rural hospitals, one-third of the total inventory of these institutions, are on unsure financial footing, according to the report. Additionally, 38 hospitals, none of them in Florida, have eliminated inpatient services since the beginning of 2023 in order to qualify for federal grants available only to rural emergency hospitals, or REHs. Overall, 9 rural hospitals, or 41% of them, have cut services. In general, these institutions operate on narrow margins, and Medicaid funding is the backbone of their funding, especially in those areas with a high rate of participation in public insurance enrollment. The report's authors said that most of the at-risk hospitals are in isolated communities, and that their closure would mean residents would be required to travel long distances for emergency, obstetric, or inpatient care. Additionally, these institutions are often the only places people can get lab tests or imaging services, and may be the principal source of primary care for the community. Hospital closures could have far-reaching economic impacts beyond the loss of healthcare service, the report warned. As a result, closure of the hospital would cause a loss of access to many essential healthcare services, the authors said. In addition, rural hospital closures threaten the nation's food supply and energy production because farms, ranches, mines, drilling sites, wind farms, and solar energy facilities are located primarily in rural areas, and they will not be able to attract and retain workers if healthcare isn't available in the community. Premiums for the ACA healthcare in Florida are expected to rise. An estimated 4 million Floridians who get their health insurance through the Affordable Care Act could see their healthcare premiums rise dramatically by the end of 2025, according to an analysis by the Congressional Budget Bill in Play. House Republicans' budget mega bill that has been advanced through 2 congressional committees would let enhanced ACA subsidies that most of the enrollees qualify for expire at the end of 2025. That would hit Florida harder than anywhere else. No other state has a higher proportion of residents getting their health care through the ACA marketplace. 20 out of every 100 Floridians are enrolled, and the vast majority of them are getting subsidies on their premiums. The mega bill that President Donald Trump is calling the One Big Beautiful Bill would advance administration priorities like beefing up border security, extending tax cuts from Trump's first term, and providing tax relief for Social Security recipients. But it would also have implications for Medicaid, a state-federal partnership providing health insurance for the neediest, and ACA enrollees who are often self-employed without access to employer-based health care. Some hardline Republicans are still withholding their support, calling for deeper cuts, but the White House is calling the bill a generational opportunity to deliver the long-term changes Americans voted for. U.S. House Speaker Mike Johnson has indicated his intention to get the bill to the floor for a vote this week before Memorial Day holiday. The administration noted that the bill's changes to Medicaid would provide the health care benefit by removing 1.4 million illegal immigrants who are gaming the system, but it's also going to affect a lot more people, according to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. The office estimates the change will result in 7.7 million people without health insurance by 2034. Shelley Gottsagen of Boynton Beach has reasons to worry about the looming cuts to Medicaid. She explained at a recent roundtable by Rep. Lois Frankel, Democrat from West Palm Beach, that both her son and her mother rely on it. Anyone can get health care insurance through the Affordable Care Act, but the range of family incomes to qualify to let government subsidies for their premiums have expanded in recent years to include the middle class. This mega bill, however, would allow the subsidies to expire. Some believe it would be a game changer for people without access to employer-sponsored insurance. It will shatter health care, predicts Alex Gulubev, who returned to selling ACA policies full-time last year through his agency, Atlantic Breeze Insurance in Hallandale Beach. Parts of Hallandale Beach are included in a congressional district where one-third of the residents are enrolled in ACA, and the vast majority receive enhanced subsidies for their health care premiums. He explained further, 99.9%, 999% of people I work with don't even have $10 to spare every month for additional costs. If there were any for a health care plan. Meanwhile, the subsidy is covering, you know, anywhere from $500 to $1,000 per person per month. Signups for the latest ACA enrollment period in Florida hit a record in January. The number of enrollees receiving government subsidies doubled between 2020 and 2024, according to an analysis from KFF, a national health policy research nonprofit. With an eye to making health insurance more affordable for low to moderate income enrollees without access to employer-sponsored health care, legislation made it so that ACA enrollees qualify for a government subsidy through the ACA marketplace. The idea is that with insurance, people will get preventative health care and not wait until the condition drives them to a hospital emergency room, which is a more expensive venue for health care. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Funding for Head Start is up in the air and appears to be blowing away like a cloud on a summer day. Head Start preschool programs for low-income U.S. children are scrambling to cope with funding cuts and delays as they feel the squeeze of President Donald Trump's cost-cutting drive. Local administrators and advocates for the program that serves nearly 800,000 children and families say the closure of five U.S. Department of Health and Human Services offices that oversee the program in Chicago, Boston, New York, Seattle, and San Francisco has led to delays in processing grant applications. Adding to the strain, Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency released $943 million less in congressional-approved funding for distribution through April 15th compared with the previous year, according to a congressional Democrat's most recent estimates. The delays left hundreds of families searching for costly private care for children through the age of five, according to Head Start Association executives in Wisconsin, Illinois, and Washington State. Administrators have sought bank loans and other lines of credit to meet their payrolls as grant approval deadlines loomed. Congress approved $12.27 billion to the program in the fiscal year ending September 30th. That funds 17,711 Head Start centers across the country, according to Tommy Sheridan, deputy director of the National Head Start Association. The administration continues to slow walk grants, Jenny Maurer, executive director of Wisconsin Head Start Association, said in a telephone interview. A Department of Health and Human Services spokesperson said in an email that the agency is following Trump's drive to cut spending and that the closure of regional offices in high-cost cities would not reduce services. HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. added in a statement, "I will ensure that the next generation of families living in poverty have access to this vital program that offers what they need to thrive." Head Start focuses on establishing an educational foundation for disadvantaged children and arming them with the social skills needed to succeed in kindergarten and beyond. It teaches early math and reading skills and provides dental, mental, and nutritional health services to children and parents at the prenatal stage through birth. One child care program in Central Washington State closed for a few days in late April while awaiting funding, said Joel Ryan, executive director of the Washington State Association of Head Start and Early Childhood Education and Assistance Programs. A Seattle Head Start program was awaiting approval on a grant request on property improvements needed to comply with state licensing requirements, Ryan said, adding, "Nobody is getting back to them." Asked about these problems, HHS spokesperson blamed outdated and inefficient systems set forth by the Biden administration. An outgrowth of the 1960s civil strife, Head Start aimed at providing opportunity for disadvantaged black families. The program, which celebrated its 60th anniversary on May 18th, has served 40 million racially diverse children and parents now at or below the $32,150 federal poverty line for a family of four living in the continental United States. The program also is accessible to children who are homeless or in foster care. The Conservative Heritage Foundation urged the termination of Head Start in its Project 2025 blueprint for the second Trump administration, saying the programs have little or no long-term academic value for children. The National Head Start Association disputes that claim, noting that participants are 12% less likely to live in poverty as adults and 29% less likely to receive public assistance. Congress is weighing Head Start funding for the next fiscal year. A partial White House budget details major spending increases and reductions across the federal government, made no mention of Head Start. Maha says fresh vegetables and fruits are good for kids. Doge says paying for plans to help grow that food is waste and fraud. First graders at John B. Wright Elementary School in Tucson, Arizona, bounced into the brightly lit lunchroom, chattering with their friends as they grabbed trays featuring juicy mandarin oranges, cherry tomatoes, and butter lettuce, all grown at nearby farms that coax fresh produce from the Sonoran Desert. Those fruits and vegetables were supplied with the help of the Federal Local Food for Schools Cooperative Agreement Program, which was set to distribute $660 million worth of food to school systems and child care facilities in 2025, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The USDA abruptly canceled the program in March as part of President Donald Trump's plan to gut the federal government. People think it's crappy food, it's processed, unhealthy, they think it's mystery meat, said Lindsay Aguilar, who heads up the Tucson Unified School District's nutrition program. Parents associate it from when we were in school 23 years ago. It is completely different from what it used to be. The Trump administration's mixed message on school meals, funding cuts alongside calls for healthier and more costly options, create a challenge for those involved with school nutrition programs, they told Reuters. As part of the Trump-inspired campaign to make America healthy again, Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has accused schools of feeding children unhealthy food laden with food dyes and additives. We need to stop poisoning our kids and make sure that Americans are once again the healthiest kids on the planet, Kennedy said at an event with the U.S. Department of Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins in late April, adding that the two agencies would be looking at school meals. Aguilar is skeptical. In my opinion, if you want to make America healthy again, you have to invest in your school nutrition programs rather than cutting them, she said. To me, it's like walk the talk. Kennedy did not respond to a request for an interview, and a department spokesperson did not respond to a request for comment. According to the National Center for Education Statistics, 29.5% of Tucson Unified School District families received SNAP food benefits in the last 12 months, well above the national average of 19.6%. Many live in so-called food deserts where there is little access to affordable, fresh food, and large grocery stores are far away. The shenanigans at Hope, Florida are being scrutinized by law enforcement for the first time. Leon County prosecutors say there is an open criminal investigation relating to information a lawmaker provided concerning the Hope, Florida Foundation. In response to a request by the Herald Times for Hope, Florida Foundation-related records that prosecutors received from Rep. Alex Andre, the records custodian for State Attorney Jack Campbell, said the information couldn't be released because it was part of an ongoing investigation. The response is the first confirmation of any law enforcement investigation related to the foundation, which was set up to support the Hope Florida program, championed by Governor Ron DeSantis and his wife, First Lady Casey DeSantis. Earlier this year, House Republicans alleged that the DeSantis administration illegally diverted $10 million from a settlement with a Medicaid contractor to a political committee controlled by the governor's then chief of staff. Campbell declined to comment. It's not clear who is leading the investigation. DeSantis, when asked by the Tampa Bay Times reporter about the probe by Campbell's office during a news conference in Tampa this week, responded, "Based on what? Well, I mean, I can tell you this has been a very successful program," DeSantis said. "Everything that's been thrown at it is pure politics. I believe in this program deeply, and I stand by it 100%, he added. Campbell, an elected Democrat whose office encompasses Tallahassee, told the Herald Times last month that he wasn't investigating because no one had brought him evidence of a crime. Since then, Andrade, a Pensacola Republican who has been leading the House investigation into Hope, Florida, has said he delivered records he compiled to Campbell's office. The information was also given to the U.S. Department of Justice, Andrade said. Hope Florida is a state program championed by Casey DeSantis, designed to move Floridians off government welfare by connecting them to churches and nonprofits who can offer them help. Its charity arm, the Hope Florida Foundation, was founded to aid that mission. Last fall, the DeSantis administration directed $10 million of a $67 million settlement with Medicaid contractor Centene to Hope Florida Foundation. The settlement was over Centene's overbilling for prescription drugs. Within days, the charity gave $5 million to two nonprofits, including one run by a CEO of the Florida Chamber of Commerce, Mark Wilson. The two nonprofits then sent at least $8.5 million to a political committee which was created to fight last year's ballot initiative that would have legalized recreational marijuana and was overseen by Uthmir. Andrade has called it an illegal diversion of Medicaid funds, which are supposed to go towards health care primarily for children, pregnant women, and low-income Floridians who are disabled. Monies from the Medicaid settlement must be placed in the state's medical care trust fund, with a portion owed back to the federal government. Last week, two Democratic members of Congress called on federal health care agencies to investigate the transactions. A spokesperson for Uthmir, who is now Florida's attorney general, posted on X, his office is not aware of and haven't received any inquiries from the state attorney. Looks like more lawfare driven by the fake news media and those politically motivated to hurt Governor Ron DeSantis, spokesperson Jeremy Redfern wrote. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Coming up next is my conversation with author and professor Michael Breens about his book, The Rivalry Peril.
I'm Lou Lorini, and I'm happy to welcome Michael Breens, associate director of the Brady Johnson Program in Grand Strategy and lecturer in history at Yale University, whose recently published book, The Rivalry Peril, How Great Power Competition Threatens Peace and Weakens Democracy, co-written with Dan Jackson, unpacks the danger of the U.S.-China trade war. How you doing, Michael? Thanks for coming on.
Great. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. You know, before we get into the book, just tell us a little bit about the focus of, the program and grand strategy that you co-direct at Yale.
Yeah,
that sounds interesting.
Yeah, it is. It's one of the great pleasures of my life to do so. So we run the program is in many ways a year-long class, and we encourage students from the college and the graduate schools to apply. So it's by admission only. So students have to apply to get into the program, and the course runs the calendar year. It's a year-long course, which is why in many ways a program, there's other things related to it. But the first semester we're with about 20 students or so, 22 students currently in the class. We're looking at classics of strategy and strategic thinkers. So for us, that's everyone from Clausewitz to Machiavelli to Martin Luther King to Franz Fanon, looking at how strategy works in both a domestic and international context, but always in a historical context. And then the students in the summer have a project they go about and do. All the students who are in the class, they're interested in some sort of change, whether that's in terms of foreign policy or social change or climate. Many students are interested in climate change. And they go out and carry out this project in the summer, and then the fall they come back having learned some insights, hopefully, from this experience, and we are then looking at more contemporaneous issues, more recent issues like immigration, U.S.-China relations, which I wrote about in this book, and climate change as well, so all various things that we're dealing with now and we'll be dealing with in the future, and we co-teach with practitioners who've been in the field. So the Grand Strategy Program is a way to get students involved in change, to get them to understand how change has happened in the past, to get them to create change themselves, and then to work with people who've been in spaces for 20, 30 years trying to create a better world in some capacity. So the ideal situation is that when they leave the program, they have a greater sense of who they are and how they can go about creating change once they leave Yale.
Yeah, sounds like a great use of a young scholar's time.
Hopefully, we think so.
Yeah, in your recent book, The Rivalry Peril, you compare the current head-to-head battle between China and the U.S. as reminiscent of the Cold War we waged with the Soviet Union when we and them were the superpowers. And while we may have won, since I guess we won because communism fell and was stopped, it was not without a cost. Why is this kind of strategy of superpowers going head to head, not such a good idea today? And what did it cost us in the Cold War?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that the Cold War was an unequivocal victory for the United States. The Soviet Union fell. The effort to contain communism and ultimately defeat the Soviet Union to a certain extent worked. It succeeded, but that's a problem for us in terms of not the actual outcome of the Cold War, but the memory of the Cold War. And like the Cold War in those terms of kind of like the United States won, the Soviet Union lost, and a long-term protracted competition with a rival superpower will ultimately lead to American victory. And it's a problem for us for a couple reasons. One is the Cold War, as I'm sure you and many of your listeners know, was incredibly violent. You saw wars, of course, across the world, in particular, Vietnam. If we just want to look at the American example, but in Afghanistan for the Soviet Union, fighting a Cold War was bloody. It wasn't a peaceful endeavor. And I think that's something to consider in terms of whether, a competition with China might spiral outward into a more violent conflagration of some kind. I think that's something to keep in mind if we're considering the lessons of the Cold War, not just that the United States won the Cold War, but that it could be also violent and lead to the deaths of many people, thousands if not millions of people, which is what happened during the Cold War. And I think the second lesson that comes out of the Cold War is that, competition can be good for the United States. That it can be good for the world. Freedom prevailed, democracy prevailed. There was this moment in the 1990s when we thought, there's nothing going to be able to challenge liberalism. It was here to stay. And that, I think, is also problematic how we think about competition with China. The idea that the United States is going to rejuvenate democracy, to rebuild its economy, compete on in climate change and technology through China rivalry. I think that's certainly going to have limited gains, but not gains for most Americans. It's not going to be a project to rejuvenate democracy akin to the New Deal or akin to the Great Society. And I think those are lessons that we're starting to see the Biden administration kind of think about great power rival with China in those terms. I think those are lessons that we should keep in mind going forward, is the potential destructiveness of competition with China, and the fact that China is integrated into the economy in ways that Soviet Union was not. So the Soviet Union is a very autarkic, closed society. China is not. And then the idea that competition will be a positive good for the United States, for Americans, and also the world. We argue in the book, we just don't see that being possible considering the nature of the conflict or rivalry we have now with China.
Yeah, you know, how can this conflict with China weaken U.S. democracy? I mean, you know, aside from the fact that, you know, we have a president that doesn't really seem to care about it.
I mean, I think it's what you see is what's been happening, particularly since COVID, is sort of the rise of anti-Asian, like anti-Chinese, but broadly anti-Asian, considering how race works in the United States, like anti-Asian attacks, you know, this sort of anti-China rhetoric that had emerged during the Trump administration, Trump 1.0, and continued throughout the Biden administration. And that rhetoric was used in ways to demonize Chinese immigrants, to demonize students from China who were coming to the United States to study in American universities. So the idea of this China threat was so all-encompassing and yet amorphous that we should be concerned about China potentially, and this is what people like Senator Tom Cotton are saying, China infiltrating our education system, trying to brainwash our children through TikTok. I mean, these are conspiratorial kind of mindsets, thinking about the ways China has an influence in the world. And I think it's destructive for a pluralistic, multiracial democracy like the United States. It erodes faith in each other, erodes faith in who we are as a pluralistic nation, and it causes kind of McCarthyism in a new way, fear of the other, fear of the enemy within, fear that we can't trust each other, can't trust our neighbor, and that everyone who's critical, or anyone who's critical of the United States, is potentially an agent of the Chinese Communist Party. I think that's destructive to politics. It's destructive to who we are as a nation. I think it's also just going to further xenophobia, further nativism, and further polarize the country in ways that we don't need, considering what's happening now, as you alluded to, with the Trump administration.
Yeah, you know, it's pointed out, in your book that, you know, it's often assumed that, you know, when a country is facing a formidable opponent, you know, everybody kind of pulls together, circles the wagon, so to speak. You know, was the country more united during the Cold War, and how about now?
I think there are certainly moments of unity. There are moments of unity, support for the Vietnam War in the early years of the war, rallying around the idea that we were facing a threat from communism abroad. I think there are points of unity in regards to, fear over nuclear holocaust during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the fear of nuclear war, and rallying people, American people, and sort of thinking about the dangers of nuclear war. But I also think that, as I alluded to, the Cold War really divided Americans. During certainly the 1950s and during the height of McCarthyism, people were really divided over who was a communist. Like any critic of the American government could potentially be labeled a communist. We were divided certainly along racial lines. The Cold War helped to heal some of those divides, but it also, because of, again, so the accusations that someone who's a critic of the American government, who's critical of racial inequality, critical of the Jim Crow South, is a communist. This is what Martin Luther King Jr. faced when he was trying to achieve racial equality in the United States. Like, he was labeled a communist by J. Edgar Hoover and people like that. And there was also just the sense that there were certain gender roles that had to be abided by during the Cold War. Women had their space in the home. They shouldn't be working outside the home, and really delayed women's rights in many ways until the 1960s. Betty Friedan, the Feminist Sikh, and National Organization for Women started to mobilize. And I think that's something to consider, too. See, there are moments of unity, moments, I think, of opportunity. We thought COVID was one of opportunity for rallying together and rallying around, you know, each other, rallying upon each other. We thought COVID was going to be one of those moments that eluded us. And I think that's also considering what's happening with the Trump administration is the case now. Like the COVID moment has eluded us, and now we're back into kind of, you know, very polarized, vicious even politics and going after each other in ways that I think are cancerous again to a body politic and to a pluralistic democracy like the United States.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up that whole COVID situation, you know, because I mean for me, you know, some people's reaction to the vaccines and it just came out of left field for
right.
me. I it was clear to me that, you know, here's this, you know, national, worldwide emergency, worldwide pandemic. If we can get a vaccine, we can get something that everybody can get. It can, you know, we can all stop wearing masks and go about our business, and we should all be on board with that. But no, there were some people that saw conspiracies in that, and it has complicated it. You know, I mean, you know as well as I do. I mean, it's not only complicated things for our response to COVID, you know, but now it's expanded and it's complicated, the nation's feelings about science in general, you know, or mistrust, you know.
I just briefly add that I think China rivalry exacerbated that. It exacerbated those conspiracy theories. Fear of China, you know, made people concerned, you know, and Trump profiting off of this, calling, you know, COVID things like, you know, the Kung Flu or the Wuhan virus or China virus. You know, I think that was also, you saw that as well, that rivalry with China or competition with China wasn't good for the United States during the COVID years, if you want to call them that, and pulling us together at a time when we should have been united against an existential threat.
Yeah, you know, and that, of course, you know, there are still people that, you know, in government, you know, that are trying to find that, you know, connection with, you know, Wuhan or the wet market, and claiming that, you know, China knew all along and China did it on purpose and it's all their fault. here's what's different now, though. You know, like the Cold War was, you know, basically a battle of ideologies, you know, democratic freedom versus communist totalitarianism, even though we supported many autocratic regimes that were like, you know, horrible totalitarian regimes, but they just promised not to be communist, so it was all cool, it was all okay. You know, today's war is about trade and money, you know, and you know, can we win this war? What's going on here?
Yeah, that's one of the main arguments we make in the book, is that there's no winning a competition with China. One, I think this is a challenge that we offer to the proponents of great power competition or rivalry with China, is like, what does winning look like? You know, is it, if we're using the Cold War as an analogy or as a metaphor to the current competition with China, that Cold War, as we just discussed, led to the fall of the Soviet Union, to the collapse of the Soviet state. Do we want to see the collapse of the CCP? Do we want to see the fall of Xi Jinping? If you do, then I think that's going to lead to a series of incidents that will destabilize China, to the point that it will destabilize trade in global markets, as you're indicating, because of China's integration into the global economy and the fact that many countries, including the United States, are dependent upon Chinese manufacturing. And China is also something to note. I think China is also outcompeting the world in many sectors. There's a recent op-ed in the New York Times by Kyle Chan on this point, where he said, look, if you look at China, you look at the numbers, China controls about 45% of the world's manufacturing. It leads in steel and aluminum, you know, those industries. It's taking the lead in climate technology and EVs and batteries and solar. There's simply no competing with, you know, it's hard to catch up. Let's put it in those terms. It's hard to catch up to the advances that Chinese government has made in these economic sectors. So the idea that we're going to compete with China, or we're going to outcompete with China on these fronts is simply not possible, I think. So instead of spending our energy for fruitless enterprise of trying to outcompete China on every domain, on every front. We should be selective about the things that we can contribute to and realize that China, yes, does pose a threat to human rights, does pose a threat to intellectual property, does pose a threat in other ways. But I don't think that competing with China, just for the sake of competing with China, because, you know, it's outpacing the United States and on various economic fronts, is going to lead to prosperity for all. And I think that's something to consider as we think about the effects of these tariffs, of the Trump tariffs, and the effects of the export controls on Chinese technology, which China has gotten around with things like DeepSeek and AI. A lot of these challenges to Chinese power aren't going to pay the dividends they want. They're not going to achieve the results that we want. So I think we need to be very careful and selective about engaging with China, looking for opportunities for cooperation as opposed to competition, and being much more strategic than we have been about U.S.-China relations going forward.
Okay, yeah, I just want to interrupt for a second. This is WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, and I'm speaking with Michael Brains, professor and author of The Rivalry Peril, you know, how we got power competition and it's a long one. Power competition threatens peace and weakens democracy, that you co-wrote with Van Jackson. Yeah, that's an important point, is this business of I think it's a misguided competition. I mean, if you think about it, you know, for some reason Trump is obsessed with, you know, trade numbers, and you know, if you look at it logically, you know, we're always going to have a trade deficit with most all countries because we're a big country. We got a lot of people and we buy a lot of stuff, mm-hmm. you know, and we can't make everything. We don't have the same structure, but of manufacturing, you know, but that doesn't mean that we're losers economically, does it? I mean, it's right. There, you know, I agree with what you're saying. There are some issues that we need, or some problems that we need to actually work with China on, most notably climate change.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a huge one, right? I mean, that's an existential threat to the planet. And neither country, China or the United States, apparently are doing a good job.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, I that's what we identify in the book, is that instead of creating an existential threat out of China, just sort of saying China is an existential threat to democracy in global terms, which I don't think it's an existential threat to global democracy. I mean, a threat perhaps, again, regionally, a threat to certain ideas of human rights, but not an existential threat globally to democracy. But thinking about what are true existential threats, like climate change, which, as you said, is that all countries, you know, around the world, great powers and small powers and middle powers are going to have to face the effects of climate change. That demands an international, agreement or a set of agreements. It demands international unity. It demands international collaboration to tackle this problem going forward, because we're already seeing the effects of climate change, and they've come at a pace that's unexpected in terms of how they're affecting us all. But the poorest nations, the ones that don't have the abilities to develop the infrastructure or develop the climate technology to mitigate the effects of climate change, they're going to be the ones who are suffering, and that's going to create a host of problems in terms of immigrants and climate refugees, you know, trying to escape, you know, areas of the world that are no longer hospitable. So I think that's something that we need to consider. And I know there are clear tensions and concerns as relates to U.S.-China cooperation on climate. But our concern is that if we don't try to engage or overcome those obstacles, then we are putting ourselves up for a disaster. And winning a trade war with China, even though we think that's an impossible task, is not going to mean much if you have rising sea levels that submerge the ability to, you know, to actually trade, to actually have functioning supply chains. You know, that's just simply not the case. So we're going to miss the forest for the trees unless we think again creatively about cooperation as opposed to competition with China.
Yeah, that is that is a very important point. And as anyone who, you know, has watched the weather for the last 10 years, you know, with any sort of memory, realizes that, yeah, the effects that were promised with, you know, increasing temperatures on the Earth are coming to fore.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
I mean, just you can name a couple of hurricanes that we had last year that, you know, hit Florida. One of them was the absolute result of the Gulf warming to its highest temperature that it ever was, and it's got to be clear to any climate deniers, but you don't hear too much talk about that. You hear a lot of, you know, coming out of the White House or Washington anymore, you know,
right.
And to pull back from, you know, international efforts, you know, to, you know, try to, I don't know, modify or, you know, mitigate climate change,
mm-hmm.
It's just not the right way to go. One last question. We're coming down to the end of this. You know, do you think that this trade war could ever exacerbate into like a shooting war? I mean, I know that was always the fear with the Cold War, that, you know, both sides had nukes and, you know, and big armies and everybody was worried that, you know, some little country in Africa or something was going to become a stage for, you know, a real head-to-head war with the United States and Russia. Do you see that happening or that possibility here?
I think it's unlikely. I think what might happen is that if the trade war persists to the point that China feels threatened and weakened, then it might be willing to engage in greater belligerence and antagonism towards Taiwan. To try to escalate the situation a little bit, or at least get, you know, if Xi Jinping and the CCP thinks that escalating tensions with Taiwan will potentially lead the United States to back off on some of the exorbitant tariffs. I mean, Trump lowered the 145% rate tariffs that, you know, then dropped down to now 30%. But if those tariffs go back up after the 3-month period, if they continue and persist, and that weakens, I think, invariably will weaken China and also the United States and their economic power, then you might see greater belligerence towards Taiwan from the Chinese perspective. I don't know, though, if that would lead to then, that's the question, is how much is Trump going to, or how much is he willing to defend Taiwan? Is he willing to defend Taiwan as a question mark overall? And then if he is willing to defend Taiwan with American power, then, of course, that would lead to a shooting war between American military and the Chinese military. I think that's a disaster. That's a disaster for the United States and China, certainly, but it's a global disaster considering how much both countries, the United States and China, are integrated into the global economy, how many countries depend upon the United States and China. And that would grind semiconductor production to a halt. You know, you'd see rates of unemployment equivalent to the Great Depression again, near 25%, it would be a global disaster. So my hope is that both the Americans and the Chinese, both President Trump and President Xi Jinping, would be willing to back off, knowing that this would be catastrophic and would unravel their societies and unravel much of the world if there were to actually engage in some sort of physical military confrontation in any capacity over Taiwan or in any capacity.
Okay. Well, you know, on that note, I want to thank you, Michael Breens, for making time for us this afternoon. And, you know, please tell our listeners how they can learn more about, you know, what's in your book and how to get it.
Sure. So my book is, as we mentioned, is The Rivalry Peril, How Great Power Competition Threatens Peace and Weakens Democracy. Is published by Yale University Press. You can get it at your bookstore online. There are some bookstores that sell it too, but it's overall trying to understand how U.S.-China rivalry emerged and where it goes from here. And this has been a great pleasure. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to share my book and to share some insights out where we are currently in the world.
Thank you, Michael. I learned a lot.
Thank you.
You have a good day.
You too.
Bye.
Bye. BreenesTime.com audio.
Many young people are more willing than their parents to share personal data, giving computer companies deeper insight into their lives. Selling data is becoming the new selling plasma. Generation Lab, a youth polling company, is launching a new product, Verb AI, today, betting that buying this data is the future of polling. We think corporations have extracted user data without fairly compensating young people for their own data, said Cyrus Beschloss, CEO of Generation Lab. We think users should know exactly what data they're giving us and should feel good about what they're receiving in return. How it works? Generation Lab offers people cash, $50 or more per month depending on use and other factors, to download a tracker into their phones. The product takes about 90 seconds to download, and once it's on your phone, it tracks things like what you browse, what you buy, which streaming apps you use, all anonymously. There are also things in it it doesn't track, like activity on your bank account. Verb then uses that data to create a digital twin of you that lives in a central database and knows your preferences. Say a political advocacy group wants to know where women under 30 get their news. They can use Verb to query one or all of the twins who fit that demographic in an interface that feels like ChatGPT. Generation Lab says this method of polling will give companies, nonprofits, and news organizations more accurate information about how young people really think by tracking their behavior instead of asking them about it. For decades, market research has been the equivalent of a doctor asking a patient to describe their symptoms. Verb is an MRI machine, Generation Lab's pitch deck says. The polling company is aiming to get 5,000 users of the tracker by the end of September. Many younger Americans consider sharing data the trade-off to being online. They're already giving away their data for free and are even more willing to share it for cash. 88% of Gen Z is open to sharing personal data with social media companies, 20 points higher than older generations, eMarketer notes. 33% of Gen Z strongly agrees with the statement, "I don't mind being tracked by website or apps," compared to 22% of older adults, according to a 2023 survey from the cybersecurity company Malwarebytes. The Florida Immigration Coalition applauded a county sheriff in Iowa who rejected a 287G collaboration agreement with Immigration and Customs Enforcement and call on county leaders to reject any collaboration with federal immigration enforcement. Not known to be a bastion of progressive values in our country or a place that is necessarily pro-immigrant, Sheriff Joseph Kennedy of Dubuque County, Iowa, stated, "If they wish to crack down on immigration, that's fine. But if that's your position, then you got to go hire the people you need and you go do the job. You don't say that this is what you want done and dump it off on other people. We don't feel that it's in our best interests to be giving up our personnel to do their job. We're not saying that this is a sanctuary area. We're not saying that this is a free-for-all for all. We're just saying that we have our own job to do, and the taxpayers of Dubuque County pay us to do that job." Florida recently passed a law that tries to push local governments and community institutions into supporting the Trump administration deportation efforts. Florida's new law says that counties that run jails have to enter into one of three types of 287G agreements with ICE, but that law does not say that local police departments have to join any of ICE's 287G programs. In fact, recently, the Florida legislature considered and rejected a bill that would have required local law enforcement agencies to sign these agreements.
Dreamstop.com audio.
You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WVPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Thanks to Michael Breens for joining us today, and stay tuned to Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman.